This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. I'm John Engel at Engel's Engel on Twitter. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit. An entire show with the great Robert Klemko this week, Andy. It's an honor.
It is an honor. He already pushed the start time back a few minutes on us, so he is moving on up.
He's turning into a broadcasting diva.
Yes.
Now, the way I heard it, the studio was occupied. I've been waiting on y'all.
Whatever.
The studio was occupied after you pushed the time back.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's good, though. Regardless, we have a great outline. The draft is so helpful because it gives us stuff to talk about.
Yeah, it definitely does. And first, Robert, how'd you spend your weekend in Chicago outside of the draft? Did you spend some time watching the fight of the century?
Well, actually, I was not in Chicago. I was in Atlanta. Coincidentally, our other staff writer, Emily Kaplan, was here as well. So her and I caught the last two rounds of the fight at a house party for the Atlanta Steam, which is the lingerie football league team here. Legends Football League. They changed the name.
Which is stupid of them to change the name from lingerie to Legends.
Well, I guess they thought it was too objectifying. They took some of the frill off of the panties that the girls wear as uniforms. So,
well, that was always their biggest issue.
Now it's way more respectful.
Yeah, the objectification of lingerie football players is always one of the biggest pressing issues of the whole league. Really, what else is there? If the objectification doesn't exist, does the league exist? Theoretically.
I'm sure you'll read it in Emily's story, but these women, they really take it seriously. I mean, they're sitting around talking strategy, and they just stomp some women like 55-6 or something.
So wait, how do you get an invite to that party? Oh, just because of Emily's story?
Emily's writing a story about them, and she was like, "Do you want to come with me?" And I was down here writing a story on something completely different, and I was like, "Yeah, let's do it."
So were you talking about odd fronts with them, and blitzing schemes and that kind of thing?
And I was talking to the quarterback more than anything, and we were going over some of the defenses they faced and in what scenarios the other teams bring pressure or play zone or man.
Is it 11-on-11 football?
It's 7-on-7.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
an interesting weekend for
Robert. Did you guys think this draft was just the most boring, banal 3 days of draft television we've ever seen?
This was the first one that I had watched every single pick because I was hanging out with two agents who had guys who were supposed to go in almost every round. And so it was kind of exciting through their eyes.
Yeah, of course.
They were really pumped to see their guys get drafted.
Yeah, and the only trade talk that actually happened before the draft. There was, what, one move in the first round? Two moves?
There were two, I think, yeah.
Two moves and the Niners moving up, which we'll get to later. But let's start here, Robert. Let's start with that top pick. We hear a lot of different things rumbling around before the draft. Maybe the Bears interested in the pick. Chip Kelly was interested in the pick. Did this all shake out the way you thought it would in the end with Jameis going first to the Buccaneers and Marcus Mariota going to Tennessee?
Yeah, I think in the end, right before the draft, there wasn't a lot of belief that any of those trades would actually get done. It was exciting to talk about in the weeks leading up to it, but I always felt that there would be more rumblings that Team A and Team B were close to a deal when the draft started, as opposed to us still wondering what was going to happen.
Yeah, and draft trades, I don't know how much you read into them, because if you think about it, every pick is for sale. So they say there's always a story, there's a headline. It's either Titans are shopping the number two pick or Titans have received multiple offers for the number two pick. That's going to be true of every single pick in the first round in every draft. It's 6 weeks leading up to it. Do you think these general managers don't talk to each other? Do you think they're out at the combine just crossing paths in the JW Marriott lobby and not mentioning, hey, I hear you're picking 17th. I hear you're picking 10th. Well, maybe we do something. I mean,
Yeah.
That's what the draft's for. So it's, I don't even pay any attention to draft rumors and teams trading the, and trying to read into that. And did they want to move up? Did they want this guy and all that? Every team's going to tell you they got exactly who they wanted. Probably one third of them did in the first round. And every pick was for sale all along, because if it wasn't, then your GM's not doing his job.
I think there's probably a higher hit rate than one third, but for the most part, I agree with you.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, okay. Two third, you think?
Well, I think every team goes in. I think there are a handful of teams that have their pick, and they're like, gosh, I hope so-and-so is there when we pick. And then I think 20 teams have a list of like three or four guys that they consider in that, all in the same category and should be around when they pick. And maybe they like one more than the other, but to say that they didn't get their guy, I think is a misnomer.
Right. And, you know, I heard a story once. This was not in the first round, but because you wonder what it's like in these draft rooms. And I think it changes. It varies from room to room quite a bit. Because I heard a story once. This was a – it's either the third round or the fifth round. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's kind of important, but it's not relevant to the point of the story. And the draft room, they had one guy they wanted. And there was a sense like, boy, we shouldn't be doing just one guy. What if we don't get the guy? And the team right before them took that guy. And one of the, like, the team president fell to his knees in the draft room and just put his hands to his head, and somebody grabbed a card, whatever the next one was, they didn't even hardly look at the name, and just rushed that in and said, that's our pick.
This was this draft?
No, this was last year's draft.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 2 years ago.
So you know the teams are just not saying?
I can't say. I mean, I know you guys hate it when I do that, but it's just these – sometimes they do fly by the seat of their pants in these draft rooms, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, probably later in the round. I mean, if you're in the fifth round, then there's probably a guy that you had a third round or second late second round grade on, and he's just fallen. And maybe you don't have the capital or the desire to trade up, but you're just hoping and praying that he's there. I could see that.
But no backup option? No backup option at all?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you got to have a contingency there. But in terms of the first round, which is what we were originally talking about, I think it's more – I think you have more of a contingency.
Robert, I want to get your opinion on the trade proposal we heard was floating around involving Chip Kelly and the Eagles trying to move up to that top spot, presumably to get Marcus Mariota. If a deal involved Fletcher Cox, some players, and even more picks – if you're the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, do you pass on Jameis and say we just have to take what's best or most tangible for the future?
Well, you have to consider that they really, really like Jameis. I don't think it was like an iffy proposition for them to get him. If you feel like you've got your quarterback of the future, you know, what's throwing in Fletcher Cox going to do? I mean, for the number one pick and a quarterback that everybody thinks – you know, is a starter in the NFL, I want three first-rounders. And I don't think that they were offering that. I don't think anybody was offering that.
Yeah, and I mean, especially to put on Tampa Bay, Fletcher Cox, you add him to that scheme, they don't need him. I mean, they already have a three technique. That's what he would play in a 4-3 zone scheme. But conceptually, it's about, yeah, trading the number one pick. There's absolutely nothing remotely close in value to that of a franchise quarterback. Nothing. I mean, if I'm the – let's take the Colts, for example. If someone came and said, what would it take for us to get Andrew Luck, I would tell them your first-round pick for the next 10 years. I mean, I would because what else are you going to get? You can't get better than the franchise QB, and that changes. Keep in mind, what happens when you have the right quarterback, and so let's – the Bucs obviously believe Winston's the right quarterback. Now, we could debate that if we want, but that's almost pointless because we're talking about – how a team approaches the draft, and that's how they feel, that Winston's their guy. If that's truly how they feel, then there's no amount that can do anything because having that guy in place impacts in such a positive way everything you can do with all of your other picks. So not only do you have the first rounder, the number one guy, but your second, third, fourth, fifth rounders for the foreseeable future are more valuable because you've got the most important pillar there.
Yeah, I think you have to factor in, like, if you think Jameis is really good or you think Marcus Mariota is really good and you're prepared to draft him, the team that you would then trade those picks to, you think will be successful because they'll have a successful quarterback. So you're not getting the number one in 2017. You're getting the number 25 pick or somewhere around there because you believe that player is good.
Great point. Yeah, great point. Yeah.
Now, most of this draft, especially at the top, seemed to be chalked up. We knew where people were going, and it all shook out relatively predictably. But in regards to Leonard Williams, Andy, who we've spoken about, you spent some time with watching film, he dropped, I mean, five teams passed on him when some were considering him a possible number one pick. Were you surprised to see him go down a little bit?
Not really. I mean, there's going to be one or two guys that drop a little bit. In Leonard Williams' case, when you're at the very top of it, then you're going to, you know, there's more drop for you available. I mean, it's hard. So the Bucks, it makes sense what they did. Tennessee, I don't think they were ever really looking at Leonard Williams, probably because he doesn't quite have a position. And that's probably why he dropped. The Jaguars obviously felt Fowler's a more impactful player. The Raiders badly needed Amari Cooper. And then we get to the Redskins, who didn't need Leonard Williams in their scheme at all and could argue that they did need Brandon Scherff. I mean, it's just a needs type of thing. If there had been a team, let's say a team needing a really good 3-4 defensive end that currently doesn't have one, and they pass on him at 2, and then a similar type of team passes at 3 or 4 or something, then maybe you look at that. And maybe you could say Tennessee was that team.
But then, not to interrupt you, but it took five teams passing on him saying they don't need him, and then the team that ended up taking him, the New York Jets, don't need him.
Need him the least, yeah. I don't quite understand that. And I know it's, well, we take the best player available. Something's going on with Muhammad Wilkerson. And right now, it looks like they don't want to pay him. And what my argument is, you draft Leonard Williams in the hopes that he one day becomes Muhammad Wilkerson. Because Wilkerson's, he's as good as anybody not named J.J. Watt. Do you agree, Robert?
I just want to rewind real quick. I mean, who do the Jets take there if they don't take Leonard Williams?
You could have gone wide receiver. You could have gone offensive line. There's...
Yeah,
I would agree.
Yeah, I'd agree with John. Wide receiver, O line. Now, look, maybe we don't know what every team's draft board looks like. Different teams.
Yeah, maybe
didn't
have a Kevin White rated anywhere close to, Leonard Williams or Amari Cooper. And Leonard Williams is simply a best available pick. You're not supposed to read anything into it in terms of insurance for Wilkerson.
Well, perhaps. But I'm looking at the next two, or not next to two, three next three picks in the draft. Kevin White. So they could have used a receiver, but okay, let's say they didn't need him, and he's not the guy quite the type they wanted, or whatever. Vic Beasley, an outside linebacker. The Jets could always use an outside linebacker. Now, the reason they don't go get one is because they feel they can manufacture pressure, but that doesn't mean you don't take one, because considering that what you've drafted instead is a defensive lineman who's probably going to come off the bench for you now. Or they could have had Eric Flowers was the guard that the Giants took. The Jets have a weakness at guard. That's one of their four or five notable spots. I mean, it's easy to say.
You can't pick a guard at 6.
Why? The Redskins picked a guard at 5. Brandon Scherff will be a guard in the NFL ultimately.
And I disagree with that pick as well. I just don't think it's a position that you even pick in the top 10. And the same with running back.
But, Robert, it's conceptually maybe you're right, but when you get in the moment and you need one, and let's say you're Washington and you have – they would not say it this way, but they have a limited running back, albeit a productive one, but there are certain things that Alfred Morris cannot do, and that has impacted Washington's scheme before. You're now bringing in Bill Callahan. You probably paid him a lot of money because he's a valuable assistant coach that you got away from, took him away from Dallas. So you're going to alter your whole zone blocking scheme to become more of a zone blocking scheme. Wouldn't you want, if you feel you can inject an all-pro type player, a Zach Martin or a Marshall Yanda or a Mike Iupati level player in there, wouldn't you want to do that for the domino effect?
I just think you're subscribing too much to the need over the talent. I can't see it. I can't see it just because your scheme calls for it, just because your success in 2015 calls for it. I think if you're picking in the top 10 in the draft, usually that means you're not very good. The odds are you're not going to make the playoffs. You just pick a building block, not necessarily a guy that fits perfectly with what you want to do, but maybe isn't rated as high as some other guys on your board.
Okay, but Scherff can be a building block. And the example is a team that's beaten out Washington in the NFC East lately with Dallas. He picked Tyron Smith in the first round at number 10 a few years ago. They went Travis Frederick, traded back up to get him late in the first round. And then they took Zach Martin at number 14 last year, even though this is a team that's gone 8-8 for every year since the last 20 years, it seems like. So, I mean, what's a building block? What is – if we're talking wide or quarterback, that's one thing. But then you get into, I think, picking nits a little bit about what a building block is at different spots, because – the alternative is, let's say you don't have a left guard. Let's say that's a weakness for you. Now you're a fundamentally different offense than you are if you've got a dominant left guard.
You're never going to convince me that you should pick a guard in the top 10. I think there's so much more responsibility, so much more asked of a tackle. I think it's easier to find a successful guard in the NFL to mask the deficiencies of a bad guard. So if that's the case and you've got a tackle and a guard rated the same way and you need a guard, maybe a little bit less than you need a tackle, I still go tackle.
Well, maybe they did. I mean, look, I agree with some of what you're saying. And maybe they did that with Scherff. Maybe they feel he's their right tackle, or maybe they think that they don't want to have to pay Trent Williams what he's going to be worth when his contract's up after this year. And so now Scherff gives them leverage or another option at left tackle. That could be what they're thinking. Where I would agree with you in general, Rob, and I mean, I disagree with you overall because I'm fine with the Scherff pick, but conceptually, what I'm hearing you say and what I kind of can understand is my theory that you don't need great offensive linemen. You just can't have bad ones. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, but what I'm saying is if you pick a guy who you think is going to start at guard for the next 10 years, and use a top 10 pick on him, you're going to look back at that draft and say, golly, we could have had a Pro Bowl wide receiver for 8 years. We could have had a defensive end that gets after the quarterback and gets 8 sacks a year. But we picked a guard. We picked a really good guard. So I just think you're going to be disappointed more often than not.
Well, but do you think the Cowboys ever did that with Larry Allen? I mean, you can do that about any draft at any position. Every draft's going to produce a few good players, and you can always look back and say, oh, we could have had that good player instead of this good player.
Bottom line, the game has changed so much since Larry Allen played. I think guard is a position that has been devalued almost as much as running back.
Okay, but look at it this way then. Let's go back. You're Washington. The GM, Scott McLaughlin, you're probably safe because it's your first year on the job. Jay Gruden, it's only your second year. But you know that nobody's ultimately super safe in the NFL. It's a win-now league. Your quarterback situation is Robert Griffin, which probably means you're going to be playing two or three guys this year, all of them who are backups. Your only chance at winning, if you're Washington, is to be a dominant running team, which is why you hire Bo Callahan, why you have Alfred Morris, and you draft another running back to complement him. And then you take a guard. Why not try to establish a firm identity that gives you the best chance to have success rather than, I mean, what would you propose that they take instead? And they don't have any other needs on offense. They actually have a very good offense other than the O-line was average.
I'm giving you the last word on this one.
Well, no, because now I feel, I mean, no, okay, well, how about this?
Come on, kids.
We'll just argue. we'll just argue about it later. Well, I'm going to come back
okay,
to you. Whenever Brandon Scherff does something well, I'm going to tweet it, and I'm just going to tag Robert Klemko in the tweet. And now I'm a big Brandon Scherff fan. Thanks a lot, because yeah. I actually thought he was pretty average coming in.
Andy just ordered the jersey on his laptop.
You've been defending this pretty average player, this guard that Washington picked for the last 10 minutes.
Well, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know much about Scherff. I know Cosell wasn't huge on him, but I'm a big fan of, for the most part, defending teams on the decisions they make, because they're the most educated people when they make the decision.
Sure,
The Jets one I don't understand, but I defend them in that. I think there's something going on there with our buddy Muhammad Wilkerson.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because I think he's a great player. You know, obviously he hasn't shown up to voluntary workouts. They said they wanted to get the contract negotiations started back in the Super Bowl. I believe Woody Johnson was interviewed then. And you've heard nothing in terms of progress. So I think there is a little bit something a little bit there behind the curtain. Maybe Leonard Williams doesn't get picked if they're completely happy with Wilkerson and they're really close to a contract extension. Who knows?
two running backs taken in that first round too, which we'll get to now. Alabama's Todd Gurley going to the Rams. Melvin Gordon going to the Chargers.
Georgia.
Right, what did I say? Alabama?
Yep.
But
you got to learn your Alabama running backs, John.
Everybody, do I? Yeah, because they do so well at the next level.
This podcast is about Alabama running backs.
Right. Trent Richardson will make his appearance.
Or Darren McFadden.
There we go.
You don't remember that?
What?
When I screwed up and called the Alabama running back, Arkansas running backs, Alabama.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Everyone's an Alabama running back.
Okay, all right. Forget. Sorry, Robert, we were looted.
Anyway, my point being that the Rams taking an almost completely opposite route than Washington, as in bringing in a running back at one of those impact picks at the top 10, number 10, actually, before that offensive line is in place. Do you agree with that move, Andy, before you have a dominant offensive line, bringing in the future at running back like a Todd Gurley?
Well, if they feel that Gurley is that special of a player, then I'm fine with that move.
Well, what I mean is that a very, very select number of running backs transcend bad offensive line play. It's usually the other way around, that a good offensive line brings up in a running back that's average or good.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I guess heading into the draft in general, I never felt like the Rams' offensive line, I don't think it's good. I do think it needs addressing, but I never felt like it was bad enough that it will devastate the team. They did draft Greg Robinson last year very high, so whether he's performed well or not, you're banking on him becoming an elite left tackle, a mauling player for you. Roger Saffold's an above-average guard. Where you're weak is at center and right guard, and they did address the positions maybe because they drafted Jamon Brown in the third round, which means that maybe they can move some people around. I mean, it's not a great line, but it's not a bad enough line where I'd say, well, we can't take Todd Gurley, this guy that we think's sensational, because we don't have the right guard and center in place.
Are you good with that pick, Robert, at 10, going running back that early?
I'm okay with it because I think they were in a situation where he was the top player on their board. A lot of evaluators that I spoke with before the draft felt there was like a drop-off after the first 8 or 9 guys. You could argue that Danny Shelton was part of that upper echelon. But Gurley's a fine pick with me. I don't mind picking the running back before you have the rest of the formula there. The guy's not going to start right away anyway. I mean, he's hurt. That's really the big concern is will he be able to come back 100%? But apparently his combine medical recheck was put him in tip-top shape. Maybe we look back on this in 5 years and say he was a steal there, Ted.
I was a little surprised that they took him when they have Trey Mason is all. I thought Trey Mason was very good as a rookie. I know Cosell liked him coming out, and I watched every one of his carries on film last year. And he's got the quickness, the suddenness, the body control. He's little. He's 5'8", but he's 207, so he's a stout 5'8". You have to look at the frame on these guys, and short does not mean small. So even if it's wrong of me to say he's little, he's not the biggest guy, though. But I guess now they're going to put Trey Mason in a complimentary role.
I think you can still have the thunder and lightning, the two running back attack in this NFL. I mean, if anything, it throws people off because everybody's drafting these nickel corners and 230-pound, 225-pound outside linebackers, and then you bring, these two, maybe with some improved offensive line play, these guys get a leg up in that division.
And that's a great point, is that fewer and fewer teams are prepared to really truly stop the run, these kind of power running games. The Rams believe that in order to compete, and I know this for sure, I've had conversations with the guys making these picks, they believe that in order to compete in the NFC West, they have to be able to run the ball because they don't have the dynamic quarterback in the passing game. They just don't have those weapons yet, and that's NFC West style of football. Now, I'm not a huge fan of, here's our division style of football, so here's how we have to play. I think you can go for whatever's your best style of football and the opponents can adjust to you. But I get what the Rams are saying with that. And the other thing to keep in mind, this defense is going to be, if not the best in the NFL by the end of the season, then easily top 5, probably top 2 or 3. And so if you are that good defensively, and it's not just a really stout defense, it's got playmakers on it. It's a blitzing type of scheme led by Greg Williams. They're fast at all 3 levels. A guy like Ogletree who can get interceptions in the flats, rangy safeties, power or pass rushers that get sacks, strip sacks. So they're banking on their defense carrying them, and so they're, it goes back to the Washington approach, and especially with the Rams, because their coaching staff and front office will not last long if they keep going 6-10, 7-9. So their thinking is, what's our best chance of winning right now? And it's, well, we're going to be a playmaking defense. We can't screw it up on offense, so let's go get Nick Foles and give him a running game.
Yeah. And who's to say that they hadn't planned to take Brandon Scherff or Eric Flowers there if either one of them was available? I think those would have been great picks, but those guys weren't around. So
that's
next
best point.
Thing is the runner first, right?
Right, and that's what we all need to remember when we're doing this, is why you can't criticize drafts. You have to be careful about it, because we don't know what these boards really look like. And the teams that are making the picks, they don't know what everybody else's board really look like either.
Now, the more peculiar pick, even given Gurley's knee issues and how highly he was drafted, the Chargers moving up two spots, giving away two picks to take Melvin Gordon.
Yeah, I mean, it's – Robert, what are your thoughts on that? I didn't have much –
I was just surprising. I wasn't like, baffled or anything. I was just like, two picks? Two?
Yeah, I was kind of the same way. I'm hoping Robert has, like, a distinct opinion on it, because I haven't thought much about this. I thought, all right, they got Melvin Gordon. That's fine.
It's fine. I mean, trading up in the first round to get the second best running back, you could always question that and poke some holes in that. But then I look at the guys picked after him, and there's no sure things there. I mean, Marcus Peters goes 18. You don't know how he's going to even survive in the NFL if he behaves the same way he did at Washington. Eric Armstead, the defensive end out of Oregon, goes to the 49ers. Probably the slowest guy off the ball on that entire Oregon defensive line, and yet he's a first rounder. Kevin Johnson, the corner, from Wake Forest, goes to the Houston Texans. Kind of a ho-hum guy, doesn't overwhelm you, started 41 games. You can plug him and play right now, but I feel like teams had him with a low ceiling. So if you had Melvin Gordon and you're the Chargers, you have him rated higher than Todd Gurley. You're happy that Gurley's gone, but you're also worried because, a couple of these teams here in the middle of the first round did need another running back. Maybe they're talking to Melvin Gordon's people and they're giving them the impression that, hey, somebody's going to make a move here if you don't.
See,
so the Chargers went up and got him.
With the depth of that running back class, though, I thought it would have been a home run for the Chargers to go after a Cam Irving kind of guy and then get a running back in those second and third rounds.
Center Cam Irving.
Well, yeah, and he can play apparently anywhere on the line. I don't know how you feel about that. But,
well, they got Chris Watt last year in the third round.
So and they went through four centers last year.
Right, but that was due to injury mostly. I mean, they have a big weakness at right guard, but I think that was due to injury there. Obviously, they felt and they signed Orlando Franklin in the offseason. So obviously, I think they feel that their offensive line, it's interesting that the teams we keep talking about, it occurs to me as we look here, they re-signed King Dunlap in San Diego. They signed Orlando Franklin, and 2 years ago they drafted DJ Fluker, and last year was Chris Watt. Not only are these new investments in offensive linemen, but these are huge, monstrous players.
Giants.
So here's a third team that's clearly looking to become run-oriented or wanting to at least have that option. And by the way, this team has Phillip Rivers, and they're still wanting to play that way.
Well, the thing is, you might not have Phillip Rivers after the move to Los Angeles if that ever happens. So why not go draft a guy that's going to touch the ball 30 times a game?
Do you think they would make that pick, and I'm asking, I have no idea. Do you think they'd make the pick under the assumption that Rivers won't be back, or like hedging against that possibility? Isn't that such a catastrophic adjustment to a team that you almost can't plan for that? You just have to hope it doesn't happen?
I think it was probably one of like a dozen factors that contributed to the pick. I don't think it sways you one way or the other.
Robert, are you a big fan of, do you ever look at the prop bets for the NFL draft?
No. I never got into that. I can't explain why. It just doesn't occur to me to look at them.
See, I don't play them because I know I'm going to lose them, but I think they're interesting. The line at wide receivers taken in the first round was 5.5, and I think I would have taken the over. I would have taken 6. It turned out to be, what was it, 5? No, 6. 6 in the first round this year, 5 last year. Is it interest you at all, the influx of wide receivers in the early rounds, especially these top picks over these last couple of years?
I think it's a natural progression of the game. It's the same reason you're seeing all of these cornerbacks drafted high, because teams need a third quarterback. And so teams need a third and fourth wide receiver now that's a starting caliber wide receiver, because all of the rules are way more conducive to passing than they were even 2 or 3 years ago. So, no, it doesn't really surprise me. The only wide receiver pick that really surprised me was Philip Dorsett to the Colts. I thought for sure this would be a defensive first-round pick.
Yeah, I was hoping we would talk about that one next. Here's how I think the running game's going real quick, and then we can talk about Dorsett, and it kind of all ties in. The three-receiver thing is sticking around. That's the new base offense in the NFL. Maybe 12 personnel, with 12 being one running back, two tight ends. If you have flexible tight ends, you can play that way. But for the most part, you need three receiving threats on the field. So whether it's in the form of an extra tight end or two wideouts or three wideouts, whatever it is, you spread out, you play in three wide receivers, one running back. Fullback is maybe coming back a little more than people realize, but overall, it's not a fullback league. We all know that. Just because that's the case, though, doesn't mean the running game's vanishing. You can still be a big downhill plodding run team out of three receiver sets, because what happens when you play in three wide is, as Robert said, you get more cornerbacks. You get a cornerback on the field. You're going to get a fifth cornerback on the field, which is why we're seeing more cornerbacks get drafted. So the defense is lightened, plus the box is lightened, because those players have to spread out and follow the receivers. So it's just, it's still power football, just with fewer bodies around it. And if you think about it, that makes so much more sense than old-fashioned power football with all these big men in there, because if you remove a body from the box, it's the same as blocking him, only there's no opportunity for error there. There's no human error involved. The block's not going to be missed. The defender's out of the box. It's like he was blocked away. But by not being there, there's more space for the running back to use. So you create space and ensure better blocking by spreading out and running. So I think we're going to see more teams continue to take running backs and big offensive linemen, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop seeing teams take wide receivers. And this draft is a really good illustration of, I think, where the league is going.
Yeah. And the guys that end up getting squeezed out when you put all of that together are the inside linebackers, the bigger run-stop specialists, outside linebackers, there's one other position I'm thinking of. Obviously, tight end is one, but there weren't a lot of great tight ends in this draft. Oh, and safety. You see Landon Collins fall out of the first round, albeit, you know, one pick, 33rd to the Giants. In favor of Demarius Randall out of Arizona State, a fast riser, but a guy that was seen to have a more diverse skill set than Collins, who was an in-the-box kind of guy.
You know, I agree with you on all that, except I think the Collins slide-out, my guess is that's more about him than about the general's position of safety, because safeties are actually getting a lot more reps now than they ever have. As long as, like, I spent a day watching Arizona Cardinals film. I'm headed to Phoenix right after the show. And Deion Buchanan is a fascinating player. He was their safety. I believe he was a first-rounder last year. He played box linebacker for him, though, because against these three wide receiver sets, teams are like you said, the inside linebacker is starting to vanish. But I think the safety is replacing it. Because, Robert, you can't have the safety and linebacker both disappear, because then who is who now becomes a middle defender?
Right. Yeah, I just think more often than, I mean, you use the Arizona Cardinals example, but I think that the cornerback is being prioritized, the bigger, stronger cornerback who can actually tackle, as opposed to bringing down the safety to play linebacker. Wouldn't you say that's way more common to have a nickel guy get 70 snaps than a safety, you know, standing down there at outside linebacker?
It could be. That gets into your personnel and your scheme and all that stuff. Because, like, all right, let's take example for why did the Cardinals play that way with Buchanan? Well, for one, Kevin Minter, their inside linebacker, has been no good, and they don't feel comfortable with him on the field very much. So they're not going to play him in nickel. So instead, they're going to go dime and have a sixth defensive back in the form of a safety. For two, their cornerbacks play man-to-man a lot, and if you're man-to-man, you're not going to be in position to play the run because you ran away from the ball following your receivers. You're not like, example, a zone team, a cover two team, gets good tackling cornerbacks, or the Steelers, another zone-type team, because those guys need to be up near the line of scrimmage and run support. But if you got a guy's running away, then your cornerbacks aren't tacklers, so therefore the burden is on the linebackers to make the tackles. and they probably feel they need a speedier linebacker, which in this case would be a safety. Keep in mind, it's all the guys are fast too. That's what's important now is the safeties or whoever's being played in the box. Whoever it is, you have to be able to move. You can't. Brandon Spikes is a great player for Bills linebacker. I forget where he is now, if he's signed anywhere yet.
I don't know that he has. I think he's still free agent.
But if you watch him on film, you go, holy crap, that's the way they teach it to play. That's old school football. And then you realize, well, wait a minute. It's old school because it means it's old fashioned. It's out of date. This guy can't move east and west. He can't run around. There's no place for him. So the guys have to be. Whoever it is out there has to be fast in the middle of the field, and then whether you want that to be a safety or a linebacker kind of depends on what you ask of your cornerbacks, I'd say.
Yeah. Interesting note, the last time we heard from Brandon Spikes, he was confused about the justice system in the wake of the Hernandez verdict.
Oh, that's right. That was profound, wasn't it? It was nice of him to admit his confusion. See, someone explains to him, here's how it works. If you kill people, you go to prison.
For a long time.
Yeah, that's the justice system.
Speaking of the justice system, this is a smooth transition. Lyle Collins.
What a smooth transition.
Yeah. Offensive lineman dropping completely out of the draft, trying to find a way to re-enter it somehow next year or supplemental draft. What did you think when this all was shaking out during the draft?
I thought that he would get picked. I thought somebody would take a seventh-round flyer on him. And the strategy to me from his camp was the most bewildering thing because I think it hurt him. The rules, the CBA states that if you get picked and you don't sign, through week 10, then you just enter next year's draft. If you do not get picked, then you just become a street free agent after your UDFA period, where you sign, you have the ability to sign some kind of small deal with like $10,000 guaranteed as a signing bonus. Now, Lyle Collins' agent came out and said, we don't want to be picked in rounds two or three. We don't want to be picked outside of rounds two or three, so don't even waste the pick. Will enter the 2016 draft, which you can't actually do. And then he said, we'll be open to signing a UDFA contract with a team once his name is cleared. Now that in itself is somewhat of a dubious proposition at this point. When you're kind of following these stories and you're hearing things from around the league, but you're not there and you don't have a source of the police and obviously you didn't see what happened. You have to be very careful about what you say and report. But there's a very good reason he didn't get picked in the first seven rounds.
Yeah, this was a really fascinating, complicated situation. One that does not have a resolution and really not even a clean resolution. I have to believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, because I don't know this kind of thing, but I have to believe that the Baton Rouge police understand what's on the line for this guy, for Lyle Collins. Keep in mind, he stands to make tens of millions of dollars, all right? And so the police understand that if his name is not cleared, this guy is not making the tens of millions of dollars. If they truly believe that there was like he is innocent or it's important to clear his name, don't you think they would have done so? I mean, don't the police aren't out to like ruin people's lives. They're just out to keep the peace. And
the police aren't out to ruin people's lives?
No, most police are not out to ruin people. Oh, are we going to turn into this, Robert? Really?
No,
Ferguson arrest.
I didn't want to say nothing.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Robert Klemko, he'll be tweeting his Ferguson arrest again tomorrow.
It's too soon.
Too soon? Well, no, Robert Klemko got his name. Robert,
I remember.
Yeah, you got all kinds of media attention for that, right? And I don't mean that you were trying to hog attention, but like that got attention, didn't it?
Yeah, which was unfortunate because it kind of took away from the reporting that I was doing down there.
Were you reporting there?
Getting detained. I didn't want to be a story, but the fact that they were being so heavy-handed with the media was a story.
Kind of a meta investigation there. Well, who were you down? Were you down there with NBC?
No, I was doing stuff for Time Magazine.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, you were? Really? How did I not know that?
Robert's everywhere, man. He just draws attention wherever he goes.
Did you write an article for the magazine for Time?
No. I contributed to two online stories, and then I was down there for us writing about the high school kids in the area. And then at night, I was, you know, contributing to the Twitter coverage of everything going on, and ended up walking back to where these rioters had been dispelled to, and the police stopped us. And then we had a loudmouth British journalist with us who wouldn't take no for an answer, and then we all just got put in handcuffs.
Okay. All right. Well, all right. So that aside, that experience aside, let's
sure.
just say in general, the Baton Rouge police don't have it in for Lyle Collins, and they understand that
yeah.
there's a guy that could make tens of millions of dollars, and all we have to do as the police department is clear his name publicly to ensure that everything goes on fine. If there's not something fishy going on with Collins, don't you think they would have done that?
Well, I think naming him as a person of interest and clarifying and making clear that he wasn't a suspect certainly did him a favor, or they were maybe trying to do him a favor. They bring him down to Baton Rouge to get his side of everything because they have a strong inclination that he's somehow involved, whether tangentially or as a primary agent. The fact that he didn't go out and scream from the rooftops, "I'm innocent," and go on ESPN and NFL Network remotely, says a lot more to me than how the police handled the situation. If you look at all of the big infractions that guys have made right before the draft, their agents make sure to put those guys out in front of cameras and make sure that everybody knows that they're contrite and to minimize the damage. So the silence from Collins has been deafening.
But, I mean, isn't it possible, though, that he's just being advised right now, hey, this – because let's understand, as important as tens of millions of dollars are, someone's life in a murder investigation, those are far more important. And maybe he was saying – someone said to him, hey, you know, you got to keep your head down and your mouth shut for a little while.
I don't know. If you got nothing to do with it, I want the world to know I had nothing to do with it. And the agents I talked to just were perplexed by this crisis management technique.
And my guess is some of their perplexion that you've talked about, Robert, has to do with also how did Collins' agent not understand the rules around undrafted free agents and entering the draft again and all that? Has that been part of the discussion, is just who is around and advising this guy right now?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't take a CBA expert to go and read through the thing and figure out that you couldn't do what they were proposing to do. So there's some sort of miscommunication happening there, whether it's the agents not knowing what they're talking about or them not relaying their intentions correctly to the media. That all kind of went into the criticism of the way Derek Gilmore, the agent, handled this. What's interesting to note, and I've now written it in two of my stories, Derek Gilmore, the agent for Lyle Collins, not only represents Lyle, but also two of the other troublemakers in this draft, and not to say that Lyle's a troublemaker, but P.J. Williams got the DUI the week of the draft, and Randy Gregory, who tested positive for marijuana and has a litany of issues that he's now notorious for, and ended up sliding into the second round. So this guy has had an extremely busy offseason.
Robert, let's go right then to Randy Gregory, the Nebraska defensive end, as we've talked this whole show, falling through the first round, getting selected by the Cowboys in the second. Dallas's pass rush, once Greg Hardy returns, will now have one of the most notorious groupings we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, and I think that they went for the highest player on their board. For a lot of teams, he was taken off of their board, but for some, they felt they could get around some of his issues. Peter King wrote about some of them in Monday Morning Quarterback, the depression. Obviously, he enters the league as a part of the drug program, meaning he's, you know, one or two more positive tests from never playing again. So a lot of risk. I think it's a big risk-reward pick. The GM that I asked about him before the draft said he was the best defensive player available, and he ends up being, what, the seventh, eighth, ninth edge rusher taken. So, you know, if they can make sure that he stays on the straight and narrow, doesn't get caught anymore, that could end up being a great pick for them.
And, you know, this stuff goes away based on how a guy plays. And a great example is Tyrann Mathieu a few years ago. That was a big story. Mathieu fell in the draft, and Arizona took a flyer on him. It's almost like nobody remembers that about Mathieu. He's been such a model citizen there and has played very well for them, and his coaching staff loves him. It vanishes. I mean, it's the league of, I guess, second chances, so to speak. I don't even know if it's that. I don't think people care about this stuff as long as you perform really well. I mean, you can't take it over the top, of course. You can't be Greg Hardy and perform really well and then have a horrible act off the field. But if we've got a guy that gets caught smoking marijuana every once in a while and now he's in the program and all that stuff, look, if he stays on the field, even if he avoids anything more than a four-game suspension over the next 5 years, nobody's going to care about any of this stuff as long as he produces.
I think you're absolutely right, and the same thing applies to Shane Ray of the Denver Broncos. First-round pick out of Missouri, you know, he gets the marijuana arrest the week of the combine. But if he stays on the straight and narrow, like Tyrann Mathieu, for the rest of the year, nobody will remember. Another Broncos pick, Bradley Roby, the Ohio State corner from a year ago. You may remember that he was found asleep and drunk with his car on, parked, and got citation for that the week of the draft.
Yeah,
that was a big deal. He slipped because of that. I believe he got picked at the end of the first round, 31. But the casual fan, most Broncos fans, have completely forgotten about that because he's a good player, and he hasn't done anything wrong since.
No, and the Roby thing's actually funny because I know the Bronco coaches feel that his Roby's problem now is he's too straight and narrow. In fact, he never was anything. He grew up in a nice neighborhood with both his parents. And he's kind of a prep boy, and I think that drunk behind the wheel thing, I can't remember how it was told to me, but it was nothing sinister about it. It was just like he chose the wrong place to sit and sleep. Like he didn't know you're not allowed to sit behind a wheel at all. You know, there was an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond, and Deborah Barone sat behind the wheel to sleep so she wouldn't drink and drive. And
I bet you're a huge Raymond fan.
Yeah, well, I like the noise of it. I don't really care about the plot. But the point is, even though I just referenced the plot, the point is, I guess there was nothing, never anything wrong with him. So that's how they feel about it. So they got a good one with Roby in that regard. What I find interesting about Shane Ray, where are they going to play him? Are they going to – because – DeMarcus Ware is not washed up. He's got time left. Now, he's not DeMarcus Ware of 2 or 3 years ago, but he's not Jared Allen yet, where he's a shell of himself. And obviously, Von Miller, we all know what he can do. So are they going to be a 3-4 hybrid multiple-type defense? I would imagine that's what they're going to be, and that's why they're asking their cornerbacks to play so much man coverage this offseason. They're telling them to be ready for that, but this has a chance to be a real playmaking-oriented defense.
Is there a chance that in nickel-type situations you bump Ware in and have Ray right next to him on the outside there?
I would think you would bump Von Miller in if you're bumping somebody in. Because Ware has always – not only has Ware always been – and I know he's bigger than Miller, so it would seem like, yeah, that's the guy you bump in. But in nickel situations, that's not about size. It's about how you get by the blocker. And DeMarcus Ware has always been, A, an edge player, and B, a weak side edge player. When he was in Dallas, they always aligned him opposite the tight end on the what they call the open side of the formation, where there's more space for him and there's no possibility of a double team. So I don't think DeMarcus Ware would be very good, quite frankly, inside. Von Miller's an excellent inside blitzer. So he becomes your inside rusher, but not as a D tackle with his hand in the dirt. They would have him stand up coming out of a two-point stance, which, by the way, more and more teams are going to be doing that with their edge rushers this year, is putting these guys in a two-point stance and going right up the middle, because it's what Todd Bowles has done in Arizona. And every coach I talked to this offseason that I asked probably 25 coaches which scheme impressed you the most, which tactics. Every single one of them said Arizona and what Todd Bowles did. And what he does that's so unique is he takes his blitzers, his pass rushers, and puts them up the middle because, A, that's the quickest path to the quarterback, and, B, if you don't get there, you at least obstruct the quarterback's vision because most passes go through the A and the B gaps. Most balls are thrown in the middle of the field. So a guy like Von Miller, who's got long arms, and so does DeMarcus Ware, in fact, those guys can easily become inside pass rushers in a different type of scheme, and I think we're going to see that with Denver.
I wonder if Bowles will do the same thing in New York now that he has this traffic jam of talent in the middle. Do you even need to send linebackers that way?
I guarantee you he will. He doesn't know any other way to play, because what else Bowles has is Darrell Revis, Antonio Cromartie, and Buster Skrine, and D. Milliner at number four. That's the best cornerback group in the NFL. So, and they're all man-to-man type of cornerbacks. So you could say the reason that they get Williams, Wilkerson, and Richardson all together, that ensures that you get in more third and long situations, because I don't see anybody running the ball successfully against that group of guys. I mean, people haven't been the last few years. You get that, but then you're going to get one-on-one matchups for them within those blitz designs still.
I think on paper, that's the best defensive cornerback group in the NFL, but in terms of experience and just what they put on the field, especially with the addition of Kerry Williams, I think it's Seattle.
No way. Seattle?
Yeah.
Not over. What do you mean in experience in terms of put on the field? The Jets have way more experience than Seattle.
But just I'm talking about together as a group in this scheme under the same coach.
Oh, boy. I struggle with that one, because I think Kerry Williams can be picked on, and that's why he's got – what's he getting paid in Seattle this year?
It was going to be something like 11 in Philly, and that's why they cut him.
So let's look up his Seattle contract. I'll do it real quick here. But the guy that he's replacing, Byron Maxwell, just made $40 million to replace Kerry Williams. So, I mean, Robert,
isn't Cromartie just as streaky?
Cromartie's streaky, but in the right scheme and opposite Revis, Cromartie's a different type of player. And he was pretty good opposite Peterson, because what Cromartie understands coverages and he reads the field really well. He's a big time student of the game. He just doesn't play with great fundamentals. So yeah, he can be streaky in that sense. But he's streaky from a studying standpoint. He'll guess wrong at times because he tends to overanalyze. Well, that's the book on him anyway from his coaches. Kerry Williams is streaky because he doesn't play well at times. He has certain limitations in his coverages. I think there's too many instances where Williams doesn't understand his help coverage concepts. And maybe he gets away with it in Seattle, because the guy who's helping him now is Earl Thomas, and that's not a bad – and he's opposite Sherman – so we know that the help probably will be coming to his side, because Sherman doesn't need the help. But Robert, Kerry Williams is making $18 million over 3 years. Maxwell made almost more than double that. So Seattle's cornerback group is worse off than it was a year ago. It's less talented.
I think Jeremy Lane ends up playing more than people think there. And yeah, Kerry Williams isn't that great. You lose Byron Maxwell, but I think the scheme made Byron Maxwell look awesome, and I think Kerry Williams fits in it.
Now, before we move on too quickly, I'm sure this was a slip, Robert, but to save you from some tweets, Shane Ray was cited the week of the draft, not the combine, and I know you know that. But
yeah, he knows that.
I know. I already hear the keys clicking, and someone with a neck beard is firing up their computer right
the
now.
The nice thing about Twitter is that's not going to stop those jackasses from sending it anyway.
Well, because we waited about 2 minutes to say it, so you know they've already sent off three of them, and now they feel foolish.
Yeah. Robert, have fun with that.
Robert's a smart guy.
Yeah.
Before we get to some stories that Klemko's working on this week, Andy, you still wanted to jump back to the Colts and that wide receiver situation.
Well, Robert mentioned that was the other pick that surprised him was
Philip Dorsett
going to Indy. And there was a story out there that some of the Colts players themselves were surprised and that they thought they needed defense as well. I kind of like the pick, because on the surface level, I almost don't count Andre Johnson being there. I know he is. I know he's still a good player, but you've got Dante Moncrief, Philip Dorsett, and T.Y. Hilton. That's too much speed to stop.
So much speed.
And you have a quarterback that extends the play really well. So they're a very, very dangerous offense. And defensively, yeah, maybe they needed some help, but they still have a solid secondary. They did sign Trent Cole.
And they also went ahead and spent pretty much the rest of the draft on defense.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. Yeah, you're right.
They have a solid secondary? They didn't have a safety as of like
two weeks ago. I'm looking at their cornerbacks. Oh. I think Mike Adams is a decent safety. Dwight Lowry, yeah, they could do some work on that. So safety might be an issue. Now, the nice thing is if you can play man coverage, that does minimize your need at safety a little bit because you guys are in man-to-man. You're not going to have a safety help a guy in man-to-man.
So is this just the Colts saying that we're gonna put up 50 points on you every week and we're okay with that and making the sacrifices on the defense?
Well, I think philosophically, Grayson doesn't believe in taking a safety, and I think that was the guy that everybody had them going there, taking Landon Collins in the first round. I don't think he values that position enough, and he felt like he could solve that problem later on in the draft.
Well, and they just had a guy like Landon Collins named Laron Landry, another big-time hitter with some coverage limitations.
The guy with no shirt size.
Yeah, and biceps that they're the size of beach balls.
Yeah.
But Landon Collins, most people believe is similar to that. So if they're getting rid of Landry, why would they draft Collins? Could be their mindset there. I'm just guessing. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't. But it could also just be they just couldn't resist the temptation. Look how fast this is. Do you think they consulted with Andrew Luck at all on this?
Oh, yeah. I think generally speaking, the top 10, 15 quarterbacks in the league get asked which receivers they like in the draft. Some of them are into that. Others aren't. You know, I remember hearing a few years ago, I think it was after the Super Bowl season, they gave Joe Flacco reels on the top 15 wide receivers and, you know, get back to us and tell us what you think. Who do you like? Whose game do you think would fit here? And they asked him again, you know, a couple weeks before the draft, and Joe hadn't even taken a look at him. So,
Flacco, the talent evaluator.
My hunch tells me that Andrew Luck is a little bit more involved than that.
I would imagine that. So, Klemko, tell us a little bit about what you've been working on. You teased it a little bit at the top of the show. You spent some time with some agents over the last week?
Yep, a couple of agents based in Atlanta. Story will come out here Wednesday or Thursday, but I wanted to know exactly what an agent does during the draft. How much influence do they have on the process? One of the most interesting things to me, well, two things really, watching them handle the seventh round. If your client doesn't get drafted, you've got to find a home for that guy. I mean, negotiations start in the sixth round and, you know, even earlier than that. And then the other cool thing was just hearing the agent communicate with teams as to whether or not their guy was going to be available later on. So the teams want to know from the agents that they trust, where do you feel like he's had the most interest? Do you think he'll be there for us in 8 picks from now? Obviously, it's to the agent's advantage to, you know, manufacture interest in his guy. So you really have to build connections and have trust between the agent and the GM for any of that negotiation to happen.
Were these agents with top-tier talent? Are you saying who you were with in the story, or is that all mum?
Oh yeah, no, it's all on the record. These guys were their Element Sports Group in Atlanta. Michael Parrott and Kevin McGuire, two awesome guys, and they had 2 third rounders, and then about 5 more guys spread out through the rest of the draft, and 1 UDFA quarterback, Dylan Thompson, South Carolina.
How many calls would they get during a tip, like the third rounders? How many calls did they get during the third round? I mean, I know
they get
the one important one, but how many times are they on the phone?
Something I tried to look at with his call log, but we couldn't go far back enough just because he'd made so many phone calls. I remember, I think the number was 100 calls made between the fifth and seventh round, and it was a similar number for, you know, the first, second, third, and fourth.
Who are they calling? I mean, who at the team? They're not calling Ryan Grigson and Ozzie Newsome directly, right? They're talking to third level down kind of guys.
It depends. There are GMs that they had conversations with. Sometimes it's scouts, sometimes it's coaches. You know, one of their guys slipped in the draft, and the coach will text them, you know, why didn't he get picked? What's the deal with so-and-so's injury? Like that. And then a lot of times it's calls with the players, kind of keeping them abreast of the situation. They have, these guys track it down to, you know, who's the most likely teams that are going to pick you, when should you expect to go, so that you're not watching it blind.
Did either of them ever yell, "Show me the money," during this process?
Oh, come on, John.
I had to
no,
ask.
But they did. There was a cool moment when they had their first ever player drafted as an agency, because they just started this agency. They broke off of a larger group, and they yelled to the guy over the phone, "You're the first ever draft pick for Element Sports." And the guy's like, "Cool."
Right. He's like, "I didn't know that when I signed. I just..." Was there any emotions from these agents that you know were surprised by, or that you saw that you found interesting over the course of the time you spent with them?
It was cool to see just how invested they were in their client's future, and not really, you know, money-hungry guys who were disappointed for themselves to see a guy slip. They're disappointed for the player, because all these players, the psychology of it is interesting to me. These guys are in control whenever they step on a football field. Like, they can impact the outcome. But when the draft starts, they're completely out of control. They just have to sit and wait to be told what city to go to in 4 days. So trying to keep those guys in good spirit, it was a big part of the job.
Now, Grady Jarrett, another guy you're following around these next couple of weeks, he fell in the draft, but that seemed to be the least of his concerns, as his house burnt down during the event.
Yeah, we'll have a story on that actually tomorrow morning.
Oh, perfect.
His house caught fire during the second round, early in the second round, the round he thought he would go in. Clemson defensive tackle, people see as more of a two-down player as opposed to a cornerstone defensive lineman. But he ends up getting drafted by the Falcons, and his childhood house is just rubble. And he's got 35 family members. They all evacuate. And so he had to go to his cousin's house to watch the draft, and then he gets drafted by the hometown team in Atlanta. So all's well.
And his dad is Jesse Tuggle.
Right. His dad is Jesse Tuggle, former Falcons linebacker. And
a big-time linebacker, too.
Announced the pick in the I think it was the fourth round there.
Yeah, and if you ask most guys who played in the early 90s, who's the hardest hitter you've ever faced? What's the hardest hit you ever took? A majority of them tell you it's Jesse Tuggle.
Yeah. It's crazy because it's not a well-known name, but there's a number of guys like that.
Right.
And great defensive players from the 80s that you just forget about. I mean,
yeah.
Scott Studwell up with the Vikings, still a scout up there. I mean, he was legendarily productive, but people don't know these guys' names anymore.
We'll wrap up the show with some news from around the league. We usually do this at the top, but with the draft, obviously, it pushes back. We mentioned the Seattle Seahawks and that defense. They let Malcolm Smith go in free agency to the Oakland Raiders. Now, not picking up the option for Bruce Irvin, that fifth-year option. Surprise either of you?
That surprises me. That surprises me, because I just keep it in simplest terms. Bruce Irvin is a good player. He's been a good pass rusher for him, a dynamic edge rusher, and when he's moved to linebacker, he's been okay at times. He's not, I mean, he's, you know, he doesn't run like a deer in the flats or anything like that. But Bruce Irvin's a good football player, and if he were to hit free agency, someone would sign him, and his guaranteed money would be around $18 million, I would guess.
I completely agree with you. Even weirder to me that they didn't really draft a guy in that mold.
Right.
Maybe they figure one of these backups that you and I have never heard of is the next Byron Maxwell to step in there and be a great contributor for that defense. But Bruce Irvin was a guy that I thought would be there for a while.
They did take Frank Clark from Michigan, the trouble guy, a little bit. Now, what I understand about him, he's a different type of player. Most people are, by the way. Remember, Bruce Irvin was a mid-first round pick. He's very explosive off the edge. The other guy that they might like, backups that people haven't heard of, this one they probably have, he's from the Niners, DeMarcus Dobbs. But look what we're talking about here. I mean, we're saying maybe this second round pick who, you know, has some character issues, or DeMarcus Dobbs. Just, I don't understand why you don't just keep Bruce Irvin, but I'm sure they have their reasons for it. Keep in mind, they have Russell Wilson's contract coming up. Bobby Wagner, I think he's still, they still need to do his contract too, don't they?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because he's still, yeah.
Yeah,
I was going to say they're probably preparing for the ripple effect of that big Russell Wilson contract.
Yeah, and also KJ Wright's got to get, unless they maybe have paid him. But the point is, I remember writing, I think a year ago, that I figured Bruce Irvin would become the odd man out in this group. Someone had to be, and maybe it is Bruce Irvin, but I'm a little surprised they still wouldn't pick up the option just to, because I don't know, you get him for a pretty decent rate at one more year. And although this is a young team, you don't know how good you're going to be. You know, you can't, you're a Super Bowl contender right now. So go in all in on it right now.
Yeah, and Bobby Wagner in his final year of his rookie deal, too. So they got all those.
And he will be re-signed. They'll get Wagner, and obviously Russell Wilson will be re-signed. So there's not enough money for everybody, but I'm a little surprised that they couldn't have found a way or at least try to milk one more year out of Irvin at least.
So 20 of 32 of those first-round draft picks from 2012 had their fifth-year options picked up by their clubs. I want your opinion on the ones that didn't. Okay.
We're going to run through a couple of them.
Yeah, we'll get yours and we'll see what Robert thinks as well. We'll start with Cowboys cornerback Maurice Claypool.
You know, I'm not really going to have much to add here.
Well, it's going to be very easy on, I mean, a lot, we're going to, here's going to become the theme, injury issue with Claiborne. We can go the next guy.
Okay, Mark Barron, safety, Rams.
Mark Barron is a top 10 pick and therefore his salary would be based on the transition tag number, not the average of the players 3 through 25 at his position. So therefore, he's a more expensive fifth-year option. And if you're the Rams, you say he's our dime back. We can't pay our dime back $10 million or whatever it would cost.
And here's the only one I found really intriguing was Nick Perry from the Packers, linebacker you've talked about liking over the last season.
I like Nick Perry, yeah. That one's a little surprising to me. I'm trying to understand or figure out why that would be. It's not vital. I mean, Nick Perry is a guy in their team. They have other Nick Perrys around. But they did alter their starting lineup. He's part of the reason Clay Matthews moved inside, because Nick Perry played well enough to get on the field.
And then Matt Khalil got his option picked up.
Surprised me there.
That's the big one there.
Yeah, and I was talking to people I know at the Vikings saying, you guys have the most fascinating decision to make because your guy was good as a rookie, left tackles are not easy to find, and your guy was really bad in years 2 and 3. It's similar to the Robert Griffin thing, but they're not locked in. They just have the option picked up.
Robert, did you see how pissed off Whitworth is this week? After
Speaking of left tackles.
Yeah, the Bengals try to go get a couple of offensive linemen, and his contract's running up after this season. He's not too pleased.
Yeah, 34 years old. It makes sense to kind of move away from a guy like that, although he's put in some good years in this league, and I think he's still a solid player. But if you'll read kind of the scenario around those two picks, they didn't really go into the draft thinking that they would go with two tackles. It just kind of shook out that way. Obviously, if you invest that much in that position, you're not going to keep some guy at 34 who's going to end up, you know, costing you what? How much would you say in a guarantee if he re-upped?
For Andrew Whitworth?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Because given
a three-year deal, something like that.
Yeah, it'd be a three-year deal, probably $10 million. I mean, you could get him on a decent price, but you don't know quite what you're getting because of his age. I get what you're saying. I think the move, I think, could very well be about Andre Smith more than Whitworth, though. I know Whitworth wants a contract, and he's upset he doesn't have one, and we all feel that way at some point in our lives. Like, we want job security. Andre Smith, though, has been inconsistent for them. He's a free agent after this season, so they probably leave him unsigned. Whitworth, they could move to right tackle if they feel the need to, or they could shuffle everybody over one spot. Whitworth was an unbelievably good left guard late in the season. It started against San Diego, week 14, I want to say it was, of 2 years ago. They put him in at left guard midway through, and he was instantly the most dominant left guard the league had seen all year long. So you could slide him back to guard. Clint Bowling, who's been a pretty good left guard for them the last few years, he played center early in his career, like his first, like 2011 rookie season. So maybe you slide him to center, you plug in the rookie offensive tackles, and everybody's happy. You've got your best five on the field. The other thing to keep in mind is Paul Alexander's he's an educated type coach. He's a teacher of offensive line philosophy. That's their offensive line coach. He's not just an old school line up and hit this tackling dummy and move the sled. He thinks the game intellectually, and I'm sure that under his tutelage, they have no problem moving their offensive linemen around to different positions.
I think more realistically for year two, you'd see one of the rookie offensive linemen slide into guard, maybe the kid from Oregon, as opposed to Whitworth.
Yeah, that could be. That could be. That gets in a little bit of just what's your philosophical belief then about how you develop a guy and where you play him. Or Jake Fishers, who you're talking about from Oregon. I'm looking at him now. He's 6'6", 306. That's a little bit light to be a guard. That's not quite the body type you want. But we also might overlook those things at times. Whitworth is 6'7". But see, Whitworth's 6'7", 335. I would think if you're going to play someone out of position, wouldn't you want the bird in the hand and go with Whitworth, who you know was dominant when he did have to do it?
Yeah, unless one of these rookies is severely disappointing, and then the odds are that that will happen.
Right. And by the way, keep in mind, Kevin Zeitler is their other guard, first-round pick, who so far has panned out pretty well. It's going to be a good offensive line one day.
Yeah, only, only weakness on that team is, what, pass rush and quarterback.
Oh, all right.
No? Was that not fair? No. Big week for you, Robert, huh? Best man at a wedding?
Oh, yeah, Robert added, Robert wanted to put that in on the outline.
Yeah, so I asked Robert, is there anything you want to add? And he throws a couple things in, but also wants us to know that he's the main attraction at the wedding.
I mean, I thought we're doing, a couple of personal things.
Yeah,
so wrong.
We are. Apparently, we are. So go ahead. It's draft week, but
give a shout out to my buddy Patrick Maloney. He's a captain in the Army. He's done two tours in Iraq, and he's getting married on Tillman Island in Maryland this weekend. It should be a good time.
Is he a listener?
He is a listener. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
That's
well,
good for
congratulations,
him. We appreciate the tours in Iraq. If by any chance. Is he related to Matt? Was it Matt Maloney?
Who is Matt Maloney?
The Rockets shooting guard from the Charles Barkley era.
Oh, my God. You've got it.
Well, how many Maloneys do you know? Let me make sure that was his name. It's not. Yeah, it's Matt Maloney.
You don't have a normal brain.
Yes, I do.
No, you don't.
You really don't.
No, you don't.
Just answer the question. Is he related to Matt Maloney?
No, he's not related.
You're on trial now, Robert. Answer the damn question.
Would you ask him, just like, when you see him next?
We'll have a mailbag segment. He can email the show.
There can't be that many Maloneys out there.
There's a lot of Maloneys. It's an extremely common Irish name.
Oh, Robert. All right.
He's not very cultured, Robert. This is what I have to deal with in Idaho is a bunch of Andy Benoits running around.
Yeah, Maloney's got its own Wikipedia thing. Maybe Robert's right.
He probably is.
Here's a list of famous Maloneys. See, this is like the
Maryland.
The Maryland thing. There's only about 25 on this list.
Well, famous ones. Not everyone can be. Are there a lot of famous Benoits?
Let me see. probably not by comparison anymore.
It's probably not
now
yet.
Now there's the wrestler Chris Benoit, right?
Yeah, and everyone's brought that up to me. I always appreciate when people do because then I know right away like what kind of person I'm talking to. Like, oh, okay, you're very.
I don't watch any wrestling. That's just the only Benoit I could think of.
There are a lot more famous Benoits, and they're probably all Benoits. Than there are Maloneys, and I'm not even on the Benoit thing I'm seeing.
Okay, we should probably wrap this up. What do you think? We can have you Google in your free time and get back to us to start off the next show.
Why in the hell am I not on the Benoit thing?
Okay, that's all we have for you this week from the MMQB podcast. We thank Robert Klemko at Robert Klemko on Twitter if you want to give him a follow at Andy_Benoit, not Andy Benoit. That's a very different person. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and we'll get you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.